And so we come to the last of the 10 paramis, which is equanimity, upekkha. And it's possible to see these 10 paramis as constituting, as being a description of the journey of practice. There's many ways in which the journey of practice is described, so you don't have to get too preoccupied with doing this one exactly. But what's nice is the idea that there is a journey. One of the central features of Buddhist thought, Buddhist approach, is a deep insight into change and impermanence. It's kind of a common thing in our lives to recognize that things are changing and things are impermanent. Buddhism kind of specializes in highlighting not only that how thoroughly things are changeable, but also that things don't change randomly. Or some things don't change randomly. That things change because of conditions. As conditions change, the things affected by those conditions will change as well. And so depending on the conditions that are brought to bear, different changes will come about. So if you live just the opposite of the first three paramis, instead of being generous, you're just thoroughly, professionally, expertly, miserly. If instead of being ethical, you are dedicated, devoted, committed to being as unethical as possible. And instead of this simplifying your life in the way that renunciation is, you're completely in love and passionate about acquisitions, acquiring and getting and having everything, not only material goods, but every possible status. You have a shirt that's full of badges and medals and awards, and acquiring lots of likes on Facebook. Just getting. It's just that's what life is about. So if those are the three things you're like really getting good at because you practice them a lot, that's going to create very different conditions in your life than if you practice generosity, ethics, and renunciation. And you can use your imagination to see that these two conditions create very different consequences and results. And if you really are really, really good at the first three, you end up at San Quentin State Prison. And there's a lot of people who have been really good at there, who've been really good at doing some of the, doing the opposite of some of these paramis. It's remarkable to go into the prison and see how some of those people turn themselves around dramatically. So Buddhist practice is we meet the world of change, of impermanence, and we're not victims to it, though the changes that the reality puts us through can be quite hard. But we're not meant to be victims of it. And one of the meanings of refuge, going for refuge, is that once you've gone for refuge, you're no longer a victim, no matter what happens to you. Because you know something, you have a reference point for what really counts and what's important and what's here in an important way. And we have a practice to meet the world of change. And one of the principles of meeting it, to be on a journey towards freedom, is that it's not so much that we're going to cause ourselves to become free or cause the path to unfold, but we put together the conditions that allows it to unfold. We put together the conditions so we can get on the Dharma vehicle, the Dharma bus that can take us. And some of that we have to, you know, sometimes it can be hard work to create the conditions, but the conditions are not the cause. The conditions are what allows something, the Dharma, to operate through us, allows something to grow and develop, allows something to unfold, allows a journey to begin to move. And it's a good journey. So, there's a number of things that we can offer, but the first three paramis are kind of the conditions we most are useful putting in place. So the being generous, opening your hearts and minds and hands to the world around you, not being self-absorbed, not being self-preoccupied, excessively self-protective, but to have the inner wealth that allows you to open and offer whatever you have that's appropriate. Your smiles, your caring, your time, your appreciation, your dinner, your supper to people, whatever it might be. And it's kind of, I can see it being valuable for this process to liberation, because liberation is to be liberated from holding tight, clinging. And so we're beginning to practice this muscle of what it's like to let go and give here. But we're doing it in a way that creates good social relationships. And it's, you know, the beginning has to do with our relationships to the world and having caring relationships, warm relationships, generous relationships. And those create really good conditions for practice. It's a lot easier to feel settled on oneself when one goes off to practice if one's relationship to people around us are, you know, decent or good and not conflictive. So to practice generosity. The second condition is that of ethics. And a little bit the ethics can, you see, is building on generosity, because once you're concerned with your relationship with other people and tuning into them in the way that generosity does, it makes sense to start becoming more sensitive to the other impacts we have on other people. And we're kind of tuned in, we're kind of becoming more friendly and caring. And so it becomes kind of somewhat natural in this journey to become more concerned with not causing harm. And it turns out that living ethically is one of the primary conditions that also gets us onto the Dharma bus. It's a condition that allows something to begin to mature and happen and move through us. The Dharma, or this inner growth, or the inner healing, the inner development, the inner flowering that happens in the path is very hard to do if we're being unethical, if we're being mean-spirited or hostile to people or greedy and stealing from people, all kinds of things. It's hard for something beautiful inside to grow when the soil is not rich, good soil. And so to be ethical. And then the third of these conditions is to begin living a little bit simpler. Renunciation has a lot to do with simplicity. To create the simplicity of mind and of heart that makes room for this inner life to begin to grow and flower. And again, it's conditions we're putting in place. It's not cause. And I think it's a profound thing to trust the inner life, to trust the Dharma or trust the heart, to allow it to kind of begin to grow and flow, develop. Come, well, you welcome it. But it has to have space. So if we're preoccupied with acquisitions and more stuff is better and filling our houses and getting more houses and filling them and getting more houses and filling them and then, you know, needing to get Bradley tanks to protect them, and then we need guns to protect the Bradley tanks, and then we need bodyguards to protect us because of all the, you know, just because bills and bills, you know, like all this concern. And it's hard for some, there's no room in there. Wanting. But to settle back, to simplify the inner landscape, to simplify the inner ecology so that something can grow, something can develop. I knew my great grandfather, and I knew him, and probably he was in his late 80s when I knew him. Died when he was 92. And I went to see him one day, and we had a little exchange that has always kind of stayed with me. He had a house, and the back of the house was kind of cement patio, I guess. And there was a crack in that patio. And in that crack, there was growing a plant, a little grass or something, a little plant was coming up. And he was so delighted by this little plant coming up, you know, through this man-made, you know, cement something. And he wanted to show me, come look at this. Life coming up. And where, you know, we'd covered it over. So there are cracks, you know, if we're all cemented over, nothing can grow. But if we start cracking open, then something can grow. Don't be afraid of a broken heart too much. Because, you know, who knows what's going to grow then, once the crack is there. Something that's special can grow that maybe otherwise doesn't have space. And so to simplify enough, to allow something to begin, make space. And one of the things that happens as we begin renouncing, letting go of claustrophobic desire, claustrophobic hostility, as we let go of preoccupation, greed, clinging to things, whatever it might be, we get to experience what it's like for there to be the absence of greed, the absence of hate, the absence of preoccupation, the absence of conceit and excessive self-concern. And that absence can feel nice. It can feel healthy. It can feel good. It can feel, this is good. And we start seeing a contrast, a simple contrast between the pain of tightening up and the goodness of releasing. The limitations of being kind of wrapped around conceit, wrapped around greed, hate, and delusion, and envy and jealousy and shame and all kinds of things. And the ease or the lightness or the openness of having put those down or released them. And that contrast is one of the primary doors onto the Dharma bus. Because once we see that contrast, we say, there's a way here. There's a way. It doesn't have to be, you know, the contracted way. It can be the open way. And it might not be easy to go there, to do that openness, to release. But then a person knows where the Dharma is, knows where the direction is. And that contrast is one of the primary definitions of wisdom. the next parami. So some degree of letting go, or things like are let go for us. Some people come on retreat, and you might think that you are struggling to let go of X. Well, you're not watching, you're not paying attention. You didn't notice that there was no TV, there was no, you know, computer, that there was no, you know, fashion magazines, and there was no, you know, people, and all kinds of things weren't here. And so it was kind of relaxing, and people kind of cook for you, and the food is there, and you kind of like, so you know you're struggling to let go of X, but in the meantime, you're letting go of all these other things because it's just the conditions are just so nice for that to do that. And you never let go of X, the whole agenda to be here perhaps. But lo and behold, you're so much more relaxed and peaceful and at ease and centered. And you know, just from being here and so many of the ordinary things that we're caught up in have kind of receded. Then they're seeing. Oh. There's one way of being, and there's a different way of being. And that's wisdom, to see that. And to see it and say, this is a way forward. I see now it's not required to be all tight and wrapped up and clinging and holding on to ideas and things and memories and ideas of, you know, all kinds of things. It's not necessary because there's this goodness, there's this something wonderful to be found in the letting go, in the absence of those things. So the presence and absence of attachments is one of the definitions of wisdom, to see that. To have that wisdom can lead us, can help us to know what to look for, what to pay attention to. If I tell you that wisdom, real Buddhist wisdom, is to understand all 78 aspects of emptiness. And we're going to sit here until you've learned all 78 and how those 78 interact with each other in 78 times, you know, to the 78th power, then you'll have wisdom. You know, you probably tune me out when I get to emptiness number two. But It's not so complicated, this Buddhist thing. It's the insight to see clearly is to see something that's so simple. And it's so simple that some people might overlook it because they want to have a much more sophisticated philosophy of, you know, philosophy of emptiness or the mind or something. But to see, you know, the hand is clutched, the hand is open. The heart is clutched, the heart is open. The mind is clutched, the mind can be open. And so that's wisdom. And with that wisdom, seeing that contrast, then we know what kind of effort to make, the energy to make. The effort is to move in the direction that helps us to relax the clutching, to relax the holding, that makes greater space for the unfolding to happen, greater space for the heart to, for us to breathe more easily, the heart to beat more easily, for the mind to be more settled in its operation, more harmonious. And so to engage in doing the practices, to persist, to keep it up, to do things like mindfulness and concentration and metta and a variety of things, that are still contributing to more conditions that helps us to move from clinging to less and less clinging. And so we have to make effort for that, persistent effort, to engage. But as soon as we engage, it's helpful to be patient because we don't cause the journey. We create the conditions for the journey, and when the bus decides to leave the station, then we go. It's not, you know, the Dharma knows. Dharma kind of unfolds. And we create the conditions. So we keep making the effort to show up, and to let go, to be generous, to be ethical. And then it has to be a lot of patience. But also patient acceptance of the value of not holding on. Because it can be frightening not to have the usual reference points. There are people who cling to their suffering, their psychological pain, because that's all they've had much of their life. It's how they understand their life, there's themselves. It's through their pain they've established relationships to other people, and they want to be related. And so they don't know how to be without the pain. And so the patient's acceptance of the challenge and willing to step forward into this unknown world, new way of being. So there's, you know, growing patience, willingness to accept, to be present. And then there's the patient's acceptance of the truth. The truth of how radically impermanent this life is and how unpredictable it is and how things can change so quickly. And they do change quickly for some people, suddenly, in ways that lives are never the same. That some of the cherished things that we hold on to are not so reliable after all. We thought they were reliable, but there you don't see them as not so reliable anymore. Some of the cherished ways or hopeful ways we try to hold on to an idea of self, the way we represented ourselves to ourselves, or we try to represent ourselves to the world around us. It doesn't make sense anymore to keep doing this representation thing, to show up and try to be someone we're not, or even try to be something to try to be what we are is sometimes a headache. It's okay to be who you are. But to try, I mean, that can be a little awkward. And so this patience with the truth and willingness to be present for the possibility of the challenge of releasing and freeing. And then the truth itself, the patient's acceptance of the truth, and then the truth, to open to the truth, to start having a sense of what is true here. And it's not some propositional truth, it's not a truth of some belief system, but we're back to the simplicity of, the truth of clinging and not clinging. The truth of being open, being available, being willing, and the truth of not. The truth of the value of being honest, really honest to oneself and to others. This is what's happening here for me. And that's kind of like, to really be honest is to avoid a spiritual bypass. We're not trying to avoid who we are, but this Dharma flower that grows in us is through us. All of who we are is included. To become whole, to be whole, is only possible if we're honest. So this importance of truth. And then there's resolve. It makes sense to, if you know what's true, then it makes sense to have a determination, to be determined on truth. Once you know what this wisdom is, can be determined on wisdom. Once you have understand about generosity and renunciation, to be determined on it. And once you know about peace, the inkling of it, to have a determination that peace is valuable. So Adrian yesterday talked about these four determinations, four resolves, for wisdom, for truth, for generosity, and for peace. The thing is that it was perfect what you said. But it's wonderful that the word for the Pali word for generosity is the same word for renunciation. It also means renunciation. So some people will translate it wisdom, truth, renunciation, and peace. And so isn't that kind of wonderful that the two words are kind of like, same word for both concepts? So you get to choose. whether you want to practice generosity or practice renunciation. And, you know, you can practice generosity and get credit for practice generosity and get credit for renunciation among your Buddhist friends. Look, or practice generosity, you know, and then get credit for practice renunciation and get credit for generosity. You know, anyway, they're closely connected. So resolve, and I love the word resolve, the English word at least, because the Latin, the roots of the word, comes from the word solvent, so you know, as a liquid solution, and so the resolve is to kind of put it back into solution. So we get all kind of knotted up and frozen into ice cubes or something, and then with our problems and issues. And then rather than solving, you know, our problems, we dissolve the problems. So the idea of resolve is connected to dissolving in my mind. It's not supposed to be hard resolve. It's not supposed to be, you know, tighten up. It's not supposed to be, you know, this. But it's really this movement towards more and more freedom. And then the ninth parami along this journey is loving kindness. I suppose that could be the first one. But loving kindness has a lot more going for it when all the other paramis have started to be developed. Loving kindness, I think, is richer and more valuable, and there's less, you know, less self in it, and less fear in it, and less clinging in it. And it's just, you know, much more of a generous act when this maturity is unfolded. And then finally we come to equanimity. It's sometimes considered the crown jewel of Buddhism, of Buddhist emotions. Even though some people are frightened by the word because it's, or put off by the word because it's, has a feeling of indifference. Some people feel like, oh, that means I'm indifferent, I'm not going to care. But equanimity purifies all the other paramis. And the sense purifies in the sense that it lets each of them kind of come forth in its clearest form. And that's pretty cool. And the ancient text that talks about the paramis kind of describes this. It says, equanimity purifies loving kindness. The function of equanimity is to see things and people impartially. Its manifestation is the subsiding of attraction and repulsion. The perfection of equanimity should be considered thus. When there is no equanimity, the offensive actions performed by beings causes agitation in the mind. And when the mind is agitated, it is impossible to practice the path of awakening. And one should also think, even though the mind has been softened with the moisture of loving kindness, without equanimity, one cannot purify the requisites of enlightenment and cannot dedicate one's requisites of merit along with the results to furthering the welfare of others. Without equanimity, one cannot offer up something without making false, offer up and be generous, the first parami, without making false discriminations over gifts and recipients. Without equanimity, one cannot purify one's virtue without thinking about the obstacles to one's life and one's vital needs. Equanimity perfects the power of renunciation, for by its means one overcomes discontent and delight. When energy is aroused to excess because it has not been examined with equanimity, it cannot perform its proper function of endeavoring. And because one is unconcerned over the wrongs done by others, one perfects the abiding and loving kindness. Equanimity is accompanied by compassion, and compassion by equanimity. Someone may ask, how can a compassionate person look upon living beings with equanimity? I think what they mean here is someone who does bad things. Some teachers say, sometimes compassionate beings show equanimity towards all living beings only when it's necessary to do so. But other teachers say, compassionate beings do not show equanimity towards living beings as such, but toward the offensive actions performed by beings. So to make a distinction between what they do and who they are, kind of. And so the focus, you know, not to confuse those two, or to define the person by what they do in this way. So here's some poems about equanimity. As a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. Such a person who is like the earth, who, like the earth, is untroubled, who is well practiced, who is like the solid trunk of a big tree, who is like a lake without mud, continues wandering no more. I like this poem from the Dhammapada. Because, you know, many of us, certainly I was, very concerned about what other people think about. I used to think very concerned about what other people thought. And people's criticism was, you know, devastating. So here's the Buddha about this. They, those other people, they find fault in one sitting silently. They find fault in one speaking much. They find fault in one speaking moderately. No one in this world is not found at fault. There has been, there is, and there will always be no person who is only criticized or only praised. And it was kind of, when I saw that, I was kind of delighted. It kind of freed me, kind of, because, you know, if you're going to live your life so that you don't get criticized, it's not going to work. Sooner or later, someone will find something to criticize about you. That's what he's saying here. If you're quiet, they criticize you for being quiet. If you speak a lot, they criticize you for speaking a lot. And if you speak just in between, someone will find fault with that. So the issue is not so much that people won't criticize us within reason. I mean, that can be overdone for sure. But maybe there can be equanimity has a function of freeing us from the blame, the praise, the fame, the disrepute that comes along. To not be caught up in our inner life doesn't have to be elated or depressed on how other people see us and what other people say about us. That's part of the function of equanimity. The other thing that equanimity is a support with is so that we don't get caught up in success and failure. Equanimity also helps with pain and pleasure. So these are the eight worldly winds. The winds that blow through the world. Praise and blame. Success and failure. Pain and pleasure. And fame and disrepute. that maybe your world has other winds, but that's the Buddha talked about these eight winds that people get caught up in. We've pushed around by, and keeps the mind spinning. And part of equanimity is to not react to those things. The mind stays peaceful, balanced, settled. An equanimous mind is not a mind that's indifferent, but it's mind that doesn't get agitated, doesn't get into a reactive mode with what goes on. And when the mind is not preoccupied or caught up in reactivity and agitation, there's more room in the mind for other things. There's more room for the other paramis to have to surface and be present in a clearer way. There's more room for wisdom. There's more room for kindness. And so equanimity is not indifference. Equanimity makes a difference for the better. It makes all the good things kind of have space and clarity and to come through. And then the ancient texts talk about how and as I read here, that part of the function of equanimity is to strengthen and develop the other paramis. So it isn't that you have to get start the journey at the first parami and get it all right first, and then get the second one all right, and then eventually. But it kind of loops back. It's a spiral, kind of growing and growing. And they all kind of, the Dharma bus, the Dharma vehicle, all these things interact and support each other. And so with greater equanimity, it's either easier to practice generosity. With greater equanimity, it's easier to practice ethics, renunciation, and so forth. And then we go do it again. And as this journey unfolds, we change. We're transformed by this. And it's a transformation that doesn't make a lot of sense to take personal credit for. Like, look what I did. Because a lot of it feels like, that we're being changed by the Dharma. We create the conditions, we create the space, and then something can grow, something evolves, something shifts and changes, something lets go, something is shed, something becomes stronger. And it's a lovely feeling, a lovely sense, to not be the agent or not be the responsible one or the one who takes the credit or the, but to feel like we're being so wonderfully supported by the Dharma, so wonderfully supported by a powerful set of conditions that awakens treasures inside of us, that touches something profound capacity that we have of a kind of growth, a development, a maturation. And so I think it's a very wonderful kind of a positive view of human nature. That it recognizes that in us there are, if the conditions are right, there are forces inside of us, movements and growth inside of us that makes us better people, brings out the best in us. But the opposite, Buddhism doesn't say that's it. I mean, if to have a true perspective of human nature has to see that in the human nature is the opposite as well. If the conditions are different, the worst in us can grow and develop. Both in there. But which of these conditions do you want to see grow, develop? And we have an important role in creating the conditions, offering the conditions that supports the treasures inside to come out. And that's partly what the paramis are about. Generosity. Sometimes they say that the benefits of generosity can sometimes come, the way it creates conditions, benefits of generosity can come even if you just fake it at first. I mean, you fake being generous. In other words, you give even if you don't feel like it. And within reason. But, it's kind of like break the ice, kind of start it going. Don't have to wait until you feel generous. Just start. And then start seeking it. And then at some point you get this wonderful feedback loop of where it starts feeling good and you feel the benefits of it, or it feels like it breaks something inside of you that opens up. Same thing with being ethical. You don't have to want to be ethical to get the benefits of being ethical. Just do it. And the benefits will come. So that might start that simply. But then we start, do what we can. And slowly, slowly, things will begin to thaw. Things will begin to heal. We'll kind of relax into the wholeness of who we are. Will begin to soften and perhaps lessen the self-loathing and shame that can be so heavy. We can relax the hostility and aversion we have to the inner, to our own mind or aspects of who we are. So equanimity is the final parami. It's the kind of considered the crown jewel of Buddhism. It's a beautiful state of mind. And equanimity, the full strength of equanimity, is built in all the other paramis. So you're not expected to have, instant equanimity just because you hear a Dharma talk. But the idea is that you can build towards it. And it's a lot easier to be equanimous if you have good relationships with the people around you. And generosity is a vehicle for that. So is ethics. It's a lot easier to have equanimity if you know that your actions have not been causing intentional harm, that you have nothing, no one has cause to blame you for doing something unethical. It's a lot easier to have equanimity if you're not, if you're not dependent on having a lot of things. It's a lot easier to have equanimity if you have wisdom. So each of these steps, loving kindness supports equanimity, resolve, to have a sense of resolve or a sense of purpose that we're dedicated to, can keep us from being swayed left and right by the winds of the world. This is what I want to do. So it's a journey to discover ourselves, to awaken aspects of ourselves. And that journey comes to a point of deep equanimity. And in the teachings on the parami, this whole path of cultivation of the paramis is for the purpose of living a compassionate life. A life of compassion, of caring, being part of this world with a loving heart, and but a heart that knows about how to be free. Compassion without freedom is complicated. Freedom without compassion maybe is not really freedom. And bringing these two together is what the paramis are all about. Freedom, compassion, the beautiful things. In this way, the flowering, the growth, the maturation of these inner flowers, this inner goodness that we have, doesn't happen independent from the flowering of the goodness in our society. These paramis are kind of deeply connected to how we live our lives in the world with others. So my hope is that as you do this practice of Buddhism, as you do this, cultivate these things and open to the paramis, to the practice, become wiser, more equanimous, that you'll feel the rich connectivity we have, an interrelatedness we have to all beings, that we're all family, we're all kin, and to have our life be a life where all beings feel supported, feel welcomed, feel cared for. Where all beings can feel that at least from us, we've become a safe person. And we offer people the gift of fearlessness, the gift of safety. It's a profound thing to do for our world. Thank you.